Roman Holtar, Reel 6.
The committee of the Lodge Ghetto, the people who ran Lodge Ghetto under Rumkowski, realized that others are being slowly murdered, or not so slowly. And they decided that whatever happens, they are going to remain alive, or they are going to keep a nucleus of people alive. So certain children of some people from Lodge Ghetto were put orphanages. And the people who, the whole hierarchy of the Jewish leadership decided whoever is going to be sent off to be murdered, they are going to stay alive, they are going to play for time. And outsiders were treated very much as outsiders. Then in 1942, in spring 1942, there was a selection which was called the Sperra, where the sick, those who didn't work, infirmed, young, were to be selected and taken away. And the ghetto was divided into zones, and each zone was cordoned off by SS with Jewish police there and selected. And you had to stay in line, and the SS who were at front used to say to the right or to the left. One person from our town who survived was the wife of the doctor who saved me and sent me to hospital when I had the appendix out. And she was a very noble character, and she had a child with her, a girl. And she lived in the same zone area as we did. And the SS officer who did the selection, and we had all to line up there, took her child away, and she went up to him and said, "Please, that's all I have in the world, spare my child." So he pushed her aside, and then he said, "Well, in which case, take me with the child." And he again pushed her aside, so she tore her blouse and exposed her breast, and she said, "In which case, shoot me." And he took out his pistol and shot her. And then suddenly something came over him. This was too much for him, and the selection had to be halted. The child screamed. She was lying bleeding dead there because he shot her in the chest. And we all had to wait in this queue to be selected. And he went away. Another officer took his part. Suddenly this sort of complete indoctrination for murder suddenly did something to him. She was an attractive woman and very strong. And then this other man carried on the selection, and my mother and I were taken. And because where we lived in that zone, the roads were very narrow, so we were put on carts. And my mother by then had big swellings on her legs, which almost reached up to her feet. She had swellings under her eyes, and she had great difficulty in walking. And when we were on this cart, she said, "You have to save yourself." And she asked me that when we come around the corner, she would tell me where to jump, that I should take my wooden clogs off and run in a zigzag fashion. And it was very compelling because she sort of got hold of me and she spoke to me as if there was no one there, if they were just privately on the cart, although the cart was full of other people. And she said, "May God be with you." And whether she said, "May God save you," or "God be with you," I don't remember now, but we came around that corner, and she said, "Even if they shoot and shout, don't stop." And at the very end of that part was a wooden bog, because we had no toilets inside our places. And I ran through that arch, and I ran in a zigzag way, and I went to the end of that part of area which was fenced off. On the other side of the fence was the Jewish fire brigade, and where the zone, another zone began, and selection finished there. And I climbed on that bog, and jumped over the fence. And as she told me to lie close to the fence, I did so, and I threw over my wooden clogs first. And suddenly, when the Jewish police and SS shouted, he came running with the Jewish policemen there, and they thought that I jumped into the mire of the toilet. And so they opened that lid, and he fired some shots into it. And they went back. And I lay very close to the fence on the other side. And then, after a while, I went back to the fire brigade people, and I said, I escaped, will you save my life? Please don't give me away. And they said, fine, we'll stay here till dusk and then go back. And I stayed there. When I went back to the place where we lived, the eiderdown was still on the bed. And I crawled into the bed and I slept. I don't know how long, but I slept for a very long time. And then I realized I was now totally on my own. And the following day when I went to work, whether it was the following day or 2 days later when the Shpara finished, people wanted to find out what happened to me, and I told them. And they told Leon Chimovich, and he came. He was head of that section, and he came and said, oh, I'm sorry about it, to hear about your mother. What will you do? So I said, well, I don't know yet. So he said, well, if I adopt you, would you like to live with us? So I said, yes, certainly. So he said, I'll speak to you tomorrow. And the next day when I came along, he said to me that being an adopted son of his, I would receive a Bayrat ration. A Bayrat ration was all the leaders, Jewish leaders of the Lodz ghetto and section leaders of important factories receive a better ration than ordinary people. It made a tremendous difference. So he said, but for being adopted, we'll take the difference between an ordinary ration and a Bayrat ration. For my children, he had three boys then, tiny boys, and you will have our protection. Before coming to work, you will also work as a cleaner of the house. You will do whatever my wife tells you to do. So you have to get up a bit earlier, do the cleaning in the house, then you come and work my section. I will arrange that you can come a little later to the metal factory. Do you say yes or no? So I said, yes, yes. I knew that with his protection I'd be able to survive, because his brother was very influential there, and he had another brother who was head of a Jewish prison.
They would have been part of this committee that you were talking about.
Yes, they were very high up, although his activities and his brother's activities, who was head of prison, weren't publicized very much. He was very influential, because suddenly our factory, the metal factory, with his ingenuity and his skill and other people's skill, became very important, one of the top factories for the production of various things for the German war effort. So through Bibov and Charnula, this was the prime factory. Other factories which were there, where uniforms were being set, which were bloodshot and torn, and they were repaired and cleaned and washed and then sent away. Then there were straw boots made. Then there was a Sattler resort, a leather resort for various things that had to be done. In fact, the whole ghetto was one enormous production area for German war effort and produced a tremendous amount of stuff. Who got paid, whether SS or Bibov or the hierarchy of the Lodz ghetto, we don't know. Our reward was simply that we receive a lunch soup or soup on our shift, which was an extra one. And the top people of factories received the Bayrat ration, which was an extra ration.
So there was this sort of hierarchy in the ghetto with the SS above and then the Jewish hierarchy.
Yes.
It wasn't a case of all Jews together. sort of mutually supporting from what you're describing?
No, in fact, at one stage, the SS came along and said to Rumkowski, you have to supply so many children. And that was after, I think, the October speech which Himmler made to SS retraining school and the Gauleiter in Posen, that all Jews must be killed. And he said, that must be done. And Rumkowski stood up in the central area of Lodz Ghetto and called a meeting where we had to attend. We had to attend the meetings where people were hung, and attend meetings where important announcements were made. And Rumkowski said, I appeal to you, give up your children. We have a demand to do so in order for you to survive. Your children must be given up. And he stood there and uttered these words. And there's also the photograph when all the orphanages were closed and all the children were loaded up onto the train to be taken to gas chambers. And you see this shot from the back where women are supervising the loading of the children and children are marching with these lovely best uniforms on, best clothing. There are various aspects in Lodz Ghetto that occurred, and I was really too starved and too occupied with what happened to really to be aware of it. In retrospect, I can just see it, what has happened. But then I was still so weak that sometimes I made notes and wrote things. And the things which I was writing was a form of childish poetry, which rhymed in Polish. And I'm grateful to really to Mrs. Wiśniewska, who was my teacher in Poland. And it was easier for me to express myself that way than to talk, because talk needed energy, and energy needed food. And I found that starvation, when you are really very thin, very starved, was that when you try to talk, your tears run, and you cannot really get the words out. The conservation of energy had to be so that you naturally understood what you could do, what you couldn't do. And once there was a sort of get-together, because Leon Humovich decided to invite his brother and the other section leaders to his home. And he managed to get extra potatoes, I don't know how, through his brother, Joseph, that he received that. And there were baked potatoes served, which was an absolutely wonderful thing. And being the adopted son, so to say, I also sat there. And Leon Humovich discovered that I had this book in which I wrote this poetry. And I wrote semi-critically about the hierarchy of the Lodz Ghetto, because I found as a child that certain things that you don't compromise on, that beyond which a human being must not go. And I found the speech of Rumkowski terrible, that at a certain point you must say, no, I will not do this, I will not say this. And although I didn't mention Rumkowski by name, I wrote something which really was not very hard to know that was Rumkowski who said that. And when this festivity of baked potatoes, another section when I was there, he called on me to read one of my poems. And he really took the book and selected that one. And I just could hardly get the words out because I was afraid I would be killed for this. But being ordered to do so, and the others listened, he asked me to read that, and I read this. And Joseph Himovich, the head of the metal factory, said, we must shelter his life. We must shelter his life. And I just could not understand that, whether he meant Rumkowski or my life. And that was it. This, in a way, his pronouncement helped me against criticism from the other section leader, and nothing happened to me. So I thought, perhaps after all, he was my ally. Our factory consisted of over 1,000 people. When the order came in 1944, during the dissolution of the Lodz ghetto, that metal factory must be kept intact, and the machines were sent off already, and that will follow. A further order came that only 500 will be taken, men, women, and children. So from the 500, there were various people who were the cronies, the friends of Józef Runkowski, who were previously working for the police, previously belonging to hierarchy of the leadership of the Lodz ghetto, who could not be excluded, and they were taken in. So the number from the metal factory became less and less, but suddenly there was a selection in order to have the 500. And first, by mistake, Leon Chymowicz, his wife and children, were also selected, and I was put aside to remain. But being adopted by him, I also jumped to be selected with Leon Chymowicz. And Leon found it was a great deed of loyalty. And then when his brother found, Josef found, that this selection was sort of haphazard, it's not the people that he wanted, he went up to the SS and said, no, no, we must reselect everybody again, because I know the people who are the best people and indispensable people in the factory. And then the selection was done again. Because I showed such loyalty, I was again taken amongst the 500, and the others were taken away. And we 500 then were one of the last transport from Lodz ghetto. Whether we were one but last or just last, I don't know. But we were taken to Marysin to be loaded up on the trains. The train was really full of various people who were put in compartments there, who were hiding in Lodz ghetto, who were rounded up by the SS. And as the compartment became full, they were locked in. And we were brought there, the 500 of us. There were sort of over 2,000 people already locked in these cattle trucks, and they were groaning and moaning because they had no water and they were overcrowded, they had no food, they had very little air, and it was like a terrible sound of the sea. These people were there and we couldn't do anything about it, and we were also under guards then. And we were put in compartments, but not so fully crowded as mostly they were. And because they were calling out for water, the news went round that we have to have water with us because we don't know how long the journey is going to take. And when we left Lodz, we had no idea really where we're going. Whether some people knew, there is one girl who was in the same transport, whom I met in Jerusalem, who had a very checkered life even after the war, who said that she and her father went up and saw a label on the one compartment which said Oświęcim, which means Auschwitz. Whether that's so or not, I didn't know. The people in my compartment didn't know. And then they took us, and really the journey from Lodz ghetto to Auschwitz, the distance not so far, but we were shunted in various places, and we had to stop for hours and many hours, and shunted again, then went on. And eventually, at dawn, we arrived in Auschwitz. And I remember there was a sort of autumn mist when we arrived, and there were these slits in the boards. And when we looked through this mist, when sun suddenly came up, it was a lovely sun, and we suddenly realized we were in a camp. And we became terribly afraid, and the fear sort of passed from man to wife to child. And suddenly we could smell the smell of fear inside the compartment. And people didn't speak very much. Some of them prayed, and some just hug the closest, the nearest and dearest. And we waited, we went through that Birkenau gate, and we waited inside the camp where the women's camp was on one side. And then in the morning, when there was light, the compartments were open. And instead of being shunted out, the German inspection went through and just looked inside the compartments, Mengele and other officers, and they said that we have to be turned round. So there was no selection, that we were all going to be going to gas chambers, because the others were in such a poor state. So he looked into two or three compartments, found everybody was in bad shape. So the Canada commando, in uniforms, helped the people to be unloaded. They really sort of were pulled down onto the ground, and they were asked, everybody had to leave the belongings behind, and we were asked to march. And Josef Himovich then realized what was happening, and said, I have a piece of paper here, a document. I must see the officers in charge. And nobody was allowed to talk. And one SS-man ran up to him, and he had a dog, and he hit him, knocked him down to the ground, and kicked him. And the dog bit him. But Himovich jumped up, bleeding that he was, and shouted louder, and attracted the attention of Mengele and the officers. And Mengele waved his hand and asked him to come forward, and then asked the SS to stop the whole convoy. They were already walking towards the crematoria. And the convoy was stopped. And he apparently said to Himovich, get some of your men to sort out the 500. And Himovich and some of his men, who were section leaders, sorted out everybody who belonged to the 500, and we were put on the sidings in sort of blocks, groups. And then Mengele, who was a very precise man, quite sort of handsome, went up and calmly said, is this everybody? Anybody else? So he said, that's everybody. He said, well, get some of your men counted up. We don't want to make any mistake. And they were counted up. And on the third, in the third group, where I was, there were also some who were working in my section. And then he said, is that correct? And the other Germans were helping to count up the other SS. And then he said, right, you can take this column on. And we were left standing. And just at the very end, there were these struggling people. One was with a beard, who looked very imposing. And one of the SS officers said to us, we're a little group of youngsters from metal factory, he said, how can you stand there and look at these elderly people without helping them? So he said, aren't you ashamed? So two of the colleagues from that group ran up and were helping. And of course, they were also taken to the gas chambers, to the crematoria. I was just about to go, but I don't know what sort of prevented me.
Did you know then about the gassings?
Well, what happened was then, a strange thing happened. As we stood there, from women's camp came a mad shrieking voice in Polish of a woman. I don't know how. And she shrieked across, which was not so far across the wire, saying, everybody's going to be gassed and burned, he said. And they are the main cause. You are going to be the dessert. You are also going to get the same sort of treatment. And this voice could be heard. Then suddenly it became silent. And we all became terribly frightened by this. And we stood there, for hours, really, without any food, without anything. And then when we stood there, an enormous container of food was put there between the three groups with a big ladle. And Himovich said, nobody must go and touch it. And we sort of were craning to see what it was. And then one of the SS came in and took this enormous ladle and showed what a thick soup it was, like that. But nobody asked us to take any. We had no containers or anything. And that was remained there. And Mengele had a terribly sadistic streak. He carried out various experiments with people. And he wanted to know whether we'll throw ourselves on the cauldron, put our heads inside, or whether we'll take it out with our hands, or what is going to happen. But nobody did anything, because Himovich passed the word around, don't do anything, stay there. And of course, we were hungry and we were thirsty, and all things had to be left behind. And we stood there till dusk. And by that time, there was this terrible smell from the crematoria of burnt flesh. And we realized that this is what flesh smells like. It was really like you scorched a chicken when it's plucked, and the chicken has feathers, and you have that smell of burning feathers with a little of flesh. It was that sort of thing. And the crematoria was not very far from there. So eventually they decided to march us, and marched us we were taken to an area which was slightly further away than the crematoria, and we were told to undress and go inside. And some people refused to go inside. So they said, well, stand against the wall. And they were beaten with whips, and they had to line up the wall. When post SS and the capos, the sadists there, turned on very strong hoses and peeled everybody inside, this strong hose was so powerful that really knocked you against the wall. You were like leaves on the ground that are being blown in. And inside stood men in these striped uniforms, all laughing, where they had to shave us under SS supervision, and pubic hair and everything else. And sometimes it's a joke, they used to cut men. And the hair, everything was shaven off. And then there was a trough, big trough of disinfectant, looked like a iodine. And you had to be submerged. And there were SS stood on top of this trough. And if you didn't submerge fully, they used to stand on you with these boots. And anyone who was cut suffered tremendously, because this stung very badly. And you had to be submerged, even your head, everything. And then you went through into showers, and water was there in the showers. And when we came out from the other side, we had to wait for uniforms to be given. And then people came to tattoo us. And then another SS officer came and said, no, no tattooing, because we don't know whether they are going to be sent on to work or not. So there was no tattooing. And after they gave us the uniforms, we had numbers on that. We were taken to gypsy section of the Birkenau camp. The gypsies were rounded up sometimes before at night, because they knew what was happening there. And so great force of SS came, and torches were lit at night, and they were led under bayonet and dogs into gas chamber. They wanted to resist, because they knew exactly that they are going to their death. And we occupied two blocks there, one for women, one for men. And the women were not put in a women's block, but were put next into this big block next to us. and all the couples and the block eldersters came to rape the women at night. And there were terrible screams and groans coming from the other block. And the husbands wept there because they could understand the shouts. But it was a free-for-all there, and that was the sort of reward to the criminals, to the German psychopaths who were sent to Auschwitz, to Birkenau, and who were in charge of blocks or couples, or couple, deputy couples.